In today's Nutrition and Life episode, I speak with Dr. Hilary Cawthon, clinical sports psychologist, mental performance consultant, and author. Hilary and I spoke about her latest book, Hello Trauma, Our Invisible Teammate, Ways to Enhance Our Inner Drive, and How We Can Embrace Personal Growth. I'm excited for you to listen to my conversation with Hilary, and please, if you enjoy the show, subscribe and give us a rating, or take a screenshot and share the episode on your social media. Thank you so much. Now onto my conversation with Hilary. Hello and welcome back to the Nutrition and Life podcast. My name is Lisa, I'm your host, and today I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Hilary Cawthon, clinical sports psychologist, mental performance consultant, and author of Hello Trauma, Our Invisible Teammate. Hilary, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, I'm excited to talk to you about your book and everything else that you're doing with sports psychology. But before we do, please tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got to where you are today.
Yeah, so I'm a clinical sports psychologist based in Austin, Texas, and I've had a private practice for, my entire career in Austin specifically for about 13 years now. And I have six other practitioners within me, which is great. We have an interdisciplinary approach from mental performance consulting to clinical psychology. So we really work on this continuum of care model with athletes, high performers, anyone who's looking to optimize themselves and just learn a little bit more on mental health and mental wellness as well. And I also am a podcast host of the highs and lows of X's and O's and an author with my book, Hello Trauma, Invisible Teammate. So really like to just kind of be a thought leader in this space as well and kind of assist in the systemic change around sport and performance to really bring the human aspect side of it. And I am a mom of four girls. Which is also a wonderful thing that I add on top of all the other things I do.
Just a small little side.
Yeah.
They're amazing. Well, very impressive. I'm super curious what got you interested in performance coaching or mental performance coaching.
Yeah. So I was an elite, an athlete since the age of four and competed at really high levels as a youth athlete and experienced an opportunity as a youth to have lots of resources and clubs and all the things when I was a kid. And then I moved to this really small town and lost access to all of the things that I was used to, my clubs, my, you know, coaches, my resources. And then winning became very easy. And my passion for sport kind of diminished a little bit because it just wasn't the same. And then I also experienced an injury. So handling the external pressure that was placed upon me with all this like microscopic lens now of my performance at 14 and really figuring out like, man, I wanted someone to talk to in a place that could understand me. And traditional psychology or counseling did not feel this desire that I wanted. And I was like, I just want someone who gets my competitive mindset. I want to be that person for athletes. Sport is so beautiful and it can teach so many things. And the crossover between the sedentary exerciser to the competitive athlete and how it always comes together and stems in this mirror of like mental health was just a passion of mine at 14. And I was like, that I'm going to be that person and figure it out. And so that kind of led me all on my way. And I did that through my studies and just kind of paved the way to figure out my career.
Amazing. So you headed into psychology knowing that you wanted to get into sports psychology. Is that correct?
Yeah. So actually I went the kinesiology path first. So, I have kind of this continuum of education because I kind of had a hodgepodge, all the things together at the time. It wasn't a streamline. So I actually studied kinesiology, sports studies, and have 6 years of the kinesiology, health and wellness and the movement and understanding and the exercise science piece of it that leads to the performance side of the continuum of care model, the mental performance consulting. I had a dual degrees while also in psychology in undergrad. And then I went on to get the master's and doctorate in clinical psychology so I could bridge that and be a licensed psychologist and really specialize in mental illness and athletes.
Wow, super cool. Very, very impressive. And I love that you have sort of all spectrums of that background, like with the kinesiology and psychology, everything together. And so then more recently, what inspired you to write your book?
Yeah, it's stemming off of a TEDx I did in 2018, which was the toxic culture of mental health in sport. And so I had always listened to my colleagues and the observations I had in organizations I worked with and just the stories and the work for my athletes of kind of these side conversations in the shadows of how sport actually is pretty detrimental to our athletes and the mental well-being. And we don't have systems in place that really build the benefits we want to have and the optimization beyond just wins and losses. We don't really set the stage up in a system that really allows them to be mentally well and free and play their best. And so I was going to speak out about it. And so I did the TEDx and then I thought through it further and saw some systems and went through and listened to stories. And I realized like I needed to do this a little bit more and I need to build off of this trauma aspect that exists and really call it what it is. You know, this environment of sport sometimes has a really negative side to it, the darker side of it. We need to discuss what that is. And so the book is kind of twofold. The first half really evokes an emotional experience of understanding what trauma is and what it feels like, whether you've been a person who's been a victim of trauma or you will know someone in your life who's experienced it. The statistics are so high. So I wanted to help people just understand and take away the pop culture side of what trauma is and use trigger terms and actually say, this is a reality of what it is, you know, how we define it, how we make meaning of it. And then I use the second half really to a call to action. It's using sport as a microcosm of society and how the system reinforces trauma to exist if we don't get it right, and kind of saying, hey, let's be better. And anyone, even if you're not an athlete or a high performer elite level, like you can relate to this book because we're all in systems and we're all experiencing these things. And so it just redefines and teaches people how we can, you know, be a little bit better with care and empathy and compassion and, you know, work through things differently.
Awesome. That sounds very, very interesting. I will most certainly link your book in the show notes. I do want to talk like kind of more broadly as well about sports psychology and some of the things that you're passionate about. And so, for example, the majority of the listeners here are going to be, you know, maybe they played some sports or participated in some competitive sports throughout high school or college, but probably now not so much, or maybe a little bit recreationally. How did even during childhood and so on sport impact our inner growth? And like if we're still competitive now, how is that showing up as a positive thing?
Yeah, I mean, sport, like I said, it has such a beautiful aspect of connectivity and the socialization and learning a lot of these life skills. A lot of my research in the beginning was around life skill development and what life skills are taught through sport. So sport can be a place that teaches us about goal setting and motivation and coping and communication. And it's why we see a lot of, you know, professionals in the future, like these companies wanting to hire athletes because they know that there's this intrinsic drive within them, this ability to push themselves beyond a certain level, work with teams. And so anyone who's a youth, if you participate in sport, like please do. It's great. It can be wonderful socialization. And a lot of youth athletes participate for fun, for socialization. And they get to mirror a lot of life lessons in this silly little game, you know. But what we see shifts is the identity formation of the athlete that then becomes a lot of who they are. And these coach dynamics become parental figures or strong mentors. So there's a lot of power dynamic in that environment as well. So you have to make sure like it's positive, it's supportive, that the role models in place are enhancing what you want in that environment. Because at some point, every athlete will take on this ownership that sport is no longer what they do, but it becomes who they are. And that's a bridge that you have to work through. And even to the listeners that have stopped and retired out of sport, whether that was high school or college, I bet some of them are still working out and they're still in their day-to-day living. And I call them, they're still athletes. They're just not the competitive athletes, right? They're recreational athletes, or some of them are competitive athletes in 5Ks and 10Ks and half marathons. And so everyone still goes through these internal struggles and pushing themselves and self-doubt. And so it's using sport as a way to figure out like, man, this is supposed to be something I love and I love to compete and I love to play. And sometimes we lose that play fun factor in our sport and exercise.
What a wonderful reminder, because I mean, all our lives are so structured and with work and everything seems to be so serious. And then some people just think sport is another thing to sort of fit in or we have to fit in for health reasons, but making sure we remind ourselves at least occasionally that yes, it should be fun as well. It should be play. I'm curious as to your advice because you mentioned sport can be a wonderful support system. But I think also for some parents, especially if they were passionate about a certain sport, they try to put that on to their kid. Or we've all seen these sort of like very, very passionate parents yelling from the sidelines of whatever, and almost forcing their kids to be athletic. How can we encourage our kids to participate in sports and become good athletes without putting too much pressure on them?
Yeah, I think the first point is let your athlete take the lead. Let your kid take the lead. I always say one season at a time, right? We're so caught up in wanting to keep up with the Joneses and get all the fancy equipment and the extra trainers and the extra lessons and long time commitments. I'm like, just take it one season at a time. They might love soccer in the fall, and in the spring they want to go do gymnastics. There's a time and place of when you need to specialize, and specialization doesn't need to exist until you're about 16 to 18 years old. Like multi-sport athletes, they've been shown, if you're like, I want my kid to go to college, and you're vicariously living through them, like multi-sport athletes, the one who get recruited. So, hey, put them in all the sports, let them play at all the things. Recreation level is a beautiful time to get them in at first before we get to the higher levels of sport, because you want to make sure they're going to have longevity and they're going to play a long time. 70% of athletes are still quitting sport by the time they're 13. And like, it doesn't change. I'm like, this stat has been the same forever. Like, it's because it's not fun. And so I think part of that is external parental pressures, or the monopolization, the money side of sport becomes a business, and it loses that aspect. But the best advice is encourage the values around you think sport is important for your family. Like, why do you want your kid to do sport? Why is it exciting for you? How can they get on the same page? And then just go one season at a time before we get into specialization.
That's a really, really good advice, I think. And I'm personally even surprised that you said that the age at which we should specialize isn't until 16 or 18. I actually would have thought it would be more like 13, 14 or something like that, but very, very good to know. And you also touched on the point that at some point it becomes part of our identity. And while I think that that can be something really great, like for instance, with our clients, if someone's having a hard time to get into exercise and so on, and I always try to work with visualization and like what would your future you try to do, or what would your healthier you, or what kind of like putting also a name to it and saying I'm a fit person, I'm a healthy person. But I think it can also be dangerous if that's your sole identity. So for instance, if all I was someone who goes to the gym and then like or a bikini competitor or whatever, and that's all that I do, and then I get injured and that falls away, I believe that can be quite dangerous. I'm sure you've seen that with some of your athletes as well. And how do you tackle that?
Yeah, I mean, I see it all the time, whether it's an injury or sitting the bench for the first time or it's retirement. Like, there's so many phases that the athletic person will go through during different teams and all that. And so, I try to just build awareness and say, yes, sport is what you do. It's not who you are. I was taught that. I was told that at 14. It's in my book where I didn't listen to a word my mom said when she said it. It took me years to understand what that actually looked like. So I talk to my athletes and say, yes, this is actually just what you do. But what are the components that make you feel like it's who you are? And building the awareness in terms of the values, the characteristics of who they are, why that means so much to them. And then I'll say, well, is that also you in a different domain? Is that you in an athletic or an academic domain, a work setting? Is it you in your social life? And then I help them build awareness and bridges of like, what are other great things they're good at that fuel them the same way that athletics does? So if they were to ever lose athletics, like, they could still thrive and shine and be great in these other aspects.
Yeah, I think that's so important to also see like how we can be us and shine our light into the world in different aspects and not just through one single thing, whether that's your work or your identity as a mom or whatever, it's important to have multiple sort of facets. Another thing that you mentioned earlier was kind of like the inner drive and the wonderful capability that sports has in order to develop that within us, like to want more, to be hungry for things. Anyone listening, I mean, no matter what age, I think it's great to have an inner drive to want more, to achieve more. How do we enhance that really?
Yeah, I think, some of us are innately born with this like drive and desire to push. And then some come in and they're like, where's my motivation, right? I'm stuck, right? You probably experience this a lot of like, they like the idea of it, but the act of doing it is really hard to initiate. And so I think figuring out for sure the why factor, the motivation that exists, what fuels them. If it's external in nature, great. We want to eventually get it to an intrinsic drive for themselves, an internal reason. But I always just find meet the person where they're at. Like, what is the current motivation? What helps you get there? And I really try to help bring awareness and meaning to like, by doing these things, what is it leading to the benefits in your life? What are the positive aspects when you do them? And should we maintain them? Is it healthy? Is it something we can kind of be consistent at? And once they can take control and ownership of it, then it doesn't become a hard. It's just something that they do and that they are going to form really good habits.
That's great. Again, like something that you do, something that's part of who you are, but not fully who you are. And just at the same time, maybe learning to reach for new things. Okay, we've achieved something, but now not seeing that as an okay, I'm going to stop now completely because I've reached that goal. But instead, how can I perhaps build on that? I think that's sometimes a mistake that people make. If now beginning of the year, as we're sort of recording this, and they might said, "Oh, I'm going to run a 10K. I'm going to run a half marathon, aiming for that." And then after that, it's like, okay, now what?
Yeah.
I think I've read some interesting studies as well about when people do achieve really high goals, like for instance, Olympic athletes or so, and they actually manage to achieve that. And afterwards, we kind of fall into a bit of a hole. And I think that kind of like connects nicely to what I was just saying now. Like I'm sure we've all experienced that. Even people like they get married and afterwards it's kind of like you fall into a hole because it was all that build up for something exciting, and then it's like, oh, okay, great, now we're married. So what? I guess. But yeah, like how do you advise someone to kind of climb out of that or prevent that from happening in the first place?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really weird phenomenon that really does exist. The Olympic blues is kind of what it's called, right? These big, like we can imagine it's going to happen in a couple of weeks for the Super Bowl, right? For the NFL teams that get to play, right? So it's very this anticlimactic experience that you build up so much and you're working so hard. And once you achieve that, then all the dopamine and the stimulant that you're having in your body is not there. And so part of it is just a chemical imbalance because we were used to training for something, getting refueled, getting that dopamine rush, the endorphins, the positive things that make us feel great isn't there. And that's the part where you have to have like a softer landing. Like we can't make it's always going to exist, but we have to have a softer landing in place. Like, okay, what are the other things I do that make me feel good? And it reminds me of a point that I think would help this, right? If you're training 4 years for 22 seconds of your life to get right for 200 meters, and then it's over, it's like, man. And if you made it, great, but if you didn't, then you're really going down in down in that part. And so part of it is actually teaching people to slow down and teaching people to have silence and to have space. And so I always kind of start with like the 5-minute mind, like seeking stillness, because we're so quick to chase, 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 that we're never able to just allow ourselves to feel that lull in that dopamine endorphin rush. We're never allowed to just feel calm and feel what it feels like not to be doing. And so a lot of the time I'm preventing this deep slope by actually just instilling stillness and instilling calmness and the mindfulness and allowing them to just be present so they aren't always chasing. So that does help a little bit. And then of course you kind of have to have your emergency self-care coping kit in the interim because it's going to feel a little bit sad and dark at those times.
That's really great. I'm such a lover of stillness. One of my favorite books is Stillness is the Key by Ryan Holiday. And yeah, I absolutely like am such a big advocate for at least 5 minutes, even 3 minutes, whatever time people can carve out and making that a bit of a routine to sit with that uncomfortable stillness. In fact, a few weeks ago, we were running a 30-day challenge, and it wasn't anything extreme. Part of that was just literally having stillness for 3 minutes. And everybody out of the group said that that was the hardest component. Like they were were also tracking their food intake. They were exercising 3 to 5 times per week and so on. And the 3 minutes of stillness was by far the hardest rated one, which was so surprising to me, but it is so uncomfortable. And they just kept saying, oh, it doesn't get like, it gets a little bit better, but it doesn't get that much better. I'm like, well, you're doing the work, you know, like you're, even if you have been going to the gym for years on end, you're not expecting that suddenly everything is super easy. It still continues to be hard.
It still gets hard, yeah.
The work in and of itself is the challenging part. But yeah, I like that. And I like that you said it is also just a chemical imbalance, and perhaps there are some practices that you advise your clients to do as well, or patients to do in order to prevent that, like things like cold plunges, or you know, that sunlight exposure that kind of help us maintain or achieve a chemical balance. Is that something that you work with as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of things that's missed, it's always how do we help people perform their best? And I'm always like, let's also do the back end of how do we recover the best? Because that is actually going to allow you to then go back and create the cycle. So a lot of my work also is these post-performance routines, like are you journaling? Like reflective practice is huge for me, you know? So you have to take care of the mental and emotional component of a post-training session or a post-competition. What are you doing physically to recover your body? Is it a cold plunge? Is it rolling out? Is it, you know, red light therapy, I think massage work. I'm a very big proponent of like salt baths, you know, things of that nature that just allow them to get in a place to like recover. So they have to physically work through that. And then also, we have to carve in like non-sport training time, you know. So what do you do for fun? What do you do that's like your off day, you know? And so finding that reset day is a big important component for us as well, where it's like, let's just reset and fill the buckets. And so there, a lot of my clients are really aware of like what are their buckets from spiritual, physical, mental, emotional, social, and knowing when they got to fill it back up and figuring out ways to do that. But it's a whole component for performance. It's not just getting you to something. It's also in that recovery nature and making sure you're eating right and doing all the things to make sure you feel your best.
I love that you have these different buckets. And I mean, again, like I'm a big proponent of personal growth in all areas, not just aesthetically or performance-wise, but I can imagine that all these components together really yield the very best results. And many of our clients, they fall more into that lull of like, they've reached their weight loss goal. And I actually keep saying that the time after you've reached your goal, if you have a specific number or whatever, or not, but the time after this, the first few weeks is actually the most quote unquote dangerous time, because we tend to just want to like go then, and then it's kind of like yeah, you should celebrate and acknowledge how far you have come, but this is where you need to still have most awareness and to, as you mentioned, keep doing the work in a different aspect, higher calories, maybe not as much training and so on, but you still need to be doing the work and having that. I think having those conversations preemptively and talking to people about expectations is so important, because otherwise they might get there, or your athletes might get there and be like, why do I feel like this? I feel like, you know, I've just been I'm super depressed and I need some medication or something like that. But yeah, going a little bit more into your book again, so kind of backtracking, how do you classify trauma in your book, and how could that relate to some of our daily listeners, or more like Gen Pop listeners?
Yeah, so it's actually for anyone. That's a beautiful thing that especially the first half of the book, right? And it's trying to just say like trauma doesn't have to be this significant what we've socialized around like a sexual assault or war, or car accident. Like it can be as simple as stubbing your toe. That is a traumatic event that happens to your body. And I help people break down the physiological aspects of what happens in our brain when we experience trauma, whether it's emotional, it's physical, it's of nature, something externally done to us impacts us in a biological way. And so I really just start from the basics of trauma is anything that you define as harm to yourself. You know, and this is what happens in your brain. And then this is what happens in our behaviors. And there's no one's trauma is bigger than the others. We have such a socialization. So it's almost like reconstructing trauma in itself or part of it, because we socialize and we'll minimize like your trauma will always be worse than my trauma, no matter what it is, you know, and it's partly to protect ourselves. You know, we don't want to make meaning of what we've gone through. And so the book, that's why it's this juxtaposition of like, hello, trauma. Like, no one wants to be like, oh, hey, you're my friend, come sit by me, right? But it will be there. It's decode, it's like a part of your brain. If you've gone through it, it's a memory marker, it's in the neurons in your system. You can't run away from it. Even if we try to hide it for so long, it still shows up in different markers. And so I really help people understand if trauma had stages like grief and loss, I'm going to take you through that in this book. And so it's welcoming the stages that someone would go through of hello gaslighting, hello minimization, hello victimization, like all the things that someone experiences and does to themselves or is placed upon them from the external factors. We're going to just open that up and we're going to emotionally experience it and then we're going to make meaning of it. And then there's kind of like, how do we get through this part of the book as well?
Very cool. And like I'm actually surprised because I myself did not expect, or like as you were talking, I was kind of like considering in my mind, okay, what sort of traumas have I experienced myself? And things I certainly previously would not have classified as a trauma, like something as quote unquote small or seemingly small to me in the past, as like last year I dropped a plate and nearly chopped off my finger, but I didn't. Like I maintained all the nerve function, had some stitches, and it's all good. But I probably wouldn't have classified it as a trauma nonetheless. That was something that preoccupied me for like 2 months, the
Absolutely.
healing and just that moment of like, what do I do now? I live on my own. Do I call someone? Is a
Yeah.
they're gonna do the job, or whatever. And that's something that came to mind. And then I for a few years I was working shift work as a police officer, and with that deprived my body of a lot of sleep. And I've always recognized that it was a hard time, but I probably would not, or I wouldn't have classified it as a trauma until your definition now kind of like reminded me of like, hey, that definitely was a trauma. So thank you for stating it in that way, and I hope that some of that the listeners are also kind of going in their mind through some of their personal events. I could imagine even like a tough childbirth, or
100%.
a hip
Any
replacement,
childbirth, right? And
anything like that. Yes,
yeah.
right, of
And
course.
a lot of the times is we don't want to admit that it's traumatic because that word has such negative charge around it, such stigma that it's bad. Like, oh, you went through a trauma, right? It's like, well, yeah, it was traumatic on my body. Like, I had 4 C-sections. Like, of course, that's like 4 surgeries of like cutting me open, removing things, taking a baby out. Like, you're helpless. Yes, it's like terribly dramatic in nature in itself.
Right.
Of it doesn't mean that it was bad. I have 4 beautiful, healthy children. There's good and bad in the nature of these things, right? And so it's redefining making meaning. I think that's the biggest feedback I've received. And I love anyone who reads the book to definitely give feedback. It fuels me in a way to know how it's impacted you. But just being a place that helps people make clarity and have words to things that they couldn't really describe or define themselves. Like, that's been the beautiful aspect of this book is people are like, thank you for like explaining and sharing what I had no idea how to make meaning of it, but this is exactly what it was. And so, it's a really great community to realize like we've all gone through this, or you for sure will know someone in your life who has, and you can start talking to them differently because of it.
Well, yeah, no, I think that's wonderful that you're honestly approaching it, or showing us how to approach trauma in that way. And so let's say the listener now has identified like a couple of areas in their life where they're like, okay, that probably was a traumatic, or I would classify that now as a traumatic event. What are some of the following steps that you describe in the book that we can do to either retrospectively use to deal with them, or deal with them now?
Yeah, so I kind of defined the way that someone goes through this and makes meaning of it in like 3 different phases, right? The first one is the minimizer. So you kind of gave the example that you minimized an experience of like, you know, slicing your finger open. And so the first step is like, where am I at on these 3 stages? Am I in the minimization phase where I'm minimizing the experience and what it did to me and how it shaped my life? Then we have this enabler part where it's the enabler is the one who kind of tries to take fault and is like, oh, it's my fault this happened, or I'm the reason this has happened this way, or that happened. And we're trying to take ownership of something that really caused us harm, but we're taking the blame for it. And we're seeing how it could be prospectively our fault in some way. And Then the next part is the moral authority. And once we get to the moral authority, this is when your brain is finally being like, you know what? That actually did cause us some pain, or it shifted our life in a different way, and it made me show up differently. And maybe it was for the positive. You show up differently in a much better way. You're assertive now and you set boundaries and you're protective of yourself. Maybe it shaped it in a different way where you need to seek help or resources, or you don't like the way things are. So the moral authority comes in and says, hey, we're going to make meaning of this. And now we're going to do something to make sure that you're living your best self and you're getting the things that you need to go be successful and go heal if you need to heal or make change in a certain way. And so I think the first step is once you've identified you've gone through something, then figure out where's your brain at and making meaning of it. And the next option is, well, what do you do? What does it look like to make meaning of it? What does it look like if we need to heal from something, or if we need to get help in an area? The listeners that are like, oh, I've gone through something. The hardest part is this idea of like healing or being healed. A lot of people who've gone through something fear this idea of saying that they're healed because they fear it's going to take away from what they've gone through. And so they don't want to erase what they've gone through. And it's kind of this idea, then maybe you're always healing, you know, maybe you will always be in a continuous healing thing. And that is okay, because people don't actually want to forget the bad that happened to them. You know, they want other people to know this was a part of their story.
So interesting, so interesting. It really, really rings true, and I think we might even be able to like rephrase that as in like we're growing or improving to go back to your previous verbiage. Because I think like for me, sometimes I have the issue with the word healing because it implies we continue to be broken. Like something, if we say, okay, it's a lifelong healing journey, that also means it's a lifelong continuing to be broken journey. Whereas like, I just don't like the way that that sits for me personally. But I'm now starting to understand the subtitle of your book really, because before that, I didn't really get it in that way, our invisible teammate. So you're truly turning it into something that helps us grow, that helps us move forward, and not just that, but like propel us forward really. And so was that kind of the idea behind the teammate, and how in which other ways can that teammate help us?
Yeah, absolutely. Because in most cases, the trauma that you wear is not visible, right? There might be some visible scars and things of that nature, but in most cases, a broad stroke statement, it is invisible. It's an emotional wound that now is that we're holding on to. And no one, you could walk in a room and you wouldn't know who's gone through what, right? And know what they're dealing with on a daily basis. And oftentimes we live in a society that we never actually stop to truly hear how someone's doing either. So we definitely aren't going to know, even if we ask how they're doing. And so it's invisible in nature. Mental illness is the invisible injury that exists because we can't see it, we can't tangibly touch it. But if it's an enemy, if it's something we don't own, then it can fight against us. But if we say it's our teammate and it can work with us and we can shape it in a different way, now we can be cohesive and we can actually live the life we want to live.
Wonderful. Yeah, that's such a great way to put it. Yeah, I'm truly fascinated. And Hillary, to sort of like round this off with, or for the last 5 minutes or so, I'd love to talk about just your personal methods for personal growth and all the things you've achieved. Because you're, I mean, talking about ambitious, right, with four kids and with your businesses and having been an athlete and so on. So I'm sure you personally have some practices as well that you attribute a lot of your success to. What does your success routine look like?
You know, I was taught early on in my training program from one of my first mentors that in order to do this work, right, you actually have to be doing the work itself for yourself. And so she had advised that you should constantly be competing. And I was like, yes, I'm going to constantly compete because if I'm working with people who are pushing themselves beyond their physical capabilities and striving through goals and failing, I need to be doing the same thing in a parallel way. I need to understand what that looks like and I need to utilize the skills. So I do constantly compete and I've shifted that over the years. I was a collegiate runner. So then I naturally went into like marathon running and had these rite of passages to run a marathon before every kid turned one, which I don't recommend that physically for your body. You should heal way more. It was terrible. So I do a lot of things wrong as well. I don't heal as much as I need to. I have a hard time taking time off. I've had to shift my brain so much. Now I'm training and a new sport. I started lifting a year ago. I never lifted really. And now I'm into big strength training, which is great as a 40-year-old woman. You're supposed to start lifting now. I learned all these wonderful things for my body. And I'm training in a sport now called High Rocks, which is like
Super
the
cool.
latest phase and craze, the sister to CrossFit. But I try to compete 3 times a year in different ways. And so that's really push myself in ways physically, mentally, that I wasn't prepared for learning something new. That's another key, chip to my success is like, how am I constantly learning in a mental capacity? How am I learning in different ways to push myself to grow? Every year, whether it's through books, a physical challenge, going to try something new, like as crazy as it sounds, my friend was like, "Hey, you should like go eat dinner by yourself. You don't like to eat dinner by yourself." And I'm like, "Oh, that's like terrifying, but let me go sit and have a meal by myself. Like breakfast, no problem. Take me to a coffee shop, no problem. But like eating dinner is a very different challenge." So little things like that that you don't really think of, but challenging yourself to grow constantly. And then, I've been a big pro I'm a huge proponent of naps. Like naps are my game changer. Like I will try to nap every single day. I really believe in the recovery aspect of my body. So bubble baths are essential. Music is my go-to. But my hack for sure is because I transition from so many different things of running a business, doing podcasts, then going and seeing clients, to then being a mom and an athlete, like scheduling my time with time blocks, being much more intentional about taking breaks. I'm very good about transition. So I use music a lot for pause, play a playlist. You're now going into this zone. When do you need to go be mom? So I think as I've aged, I've gotten better about like, hey, let me slow down and be in the process and stop the chasing. But I think it's all about, like you said, like how are we growing? How are we pushing? And like, yeah, give me a bubble bath every single day. That would be my like wind down, like best way of recovering mentally and emotionally for sure.
Well, I'm so amazed because many people listening to this are also on the side of struggling to take rest. They're probably the type A person that's always like more, more, more is better, and give me this, and they're really struggling to take that break. So everyone listening, I really want to highlight what Hillary was saying about like part of her magic ingredient for doing all these amazing things is also prioritizing rest, because it can only go so well if we keep burning the candle all the time without taking a break for so long, and eventually our body or our mind or both or our environment is forcing us to stop. So really cool. I love the bubble baths, and I hear from a lot of people that they use more breath work to transition in and out of activated or parasympathetic into sympathetic sort of stages. But I love the use of music, because that I think is almost easy. Like, let's just say you're driving from one place to another. Like, okay, I need to calm down a little bit. I'm going to put on some piano music,
Yes,
or I want to amp
absolutely.
myself up to go and do this workout. I'm going to turn up the tunes and, dance and sing in the car, and that's really, really great. But yeah, do you have any additional advice for that person that struggles more with the rest, with the letting go of control, and so on?
Yeah, I think back to the first thing is just like I call it 5 minutes, 5-minute mind, like sitting in stillness in 5 minutes intentionally, because that's going to allow your brain to like pull in, like, what are you most worried about, right? What is coming to the surface for you? And it's teaching you that it's okay to slow down. Like, it's okay to just pause, and actually, the benefits you have by just resting, you're going to want more and more of it. Like, if you can get to 15 minutes a day, it's really not that long. Like but it seems like forever, right? And I think then you'll realize, how do I shift my priorities? And it really starts with just a self-reflection. So always use your notes on your phone, or have a journal by you, or a little post-it note when you're sitting in the stillness to figure out, like, let me make meaning of these thoughts that showed up. Why was this hard for me? Because then you can really start to make some changes.
That's awesome. And I think a lot of people think that they're doing downtime when they're like, oh, I'm scrolling through my phone, this is my relaxing time. It's not relaxing. Like, your brain is still going to be active. You might see something upsetting. You might get a message that's, I don't know, that requires you to schedule something else. I'm sure we all could take some of our scrolling time and make that into 3 to 5 minutes of stillness
Yes.
time.
Yeah, I would challenge you. Like, I mean, Huberman speaks about this a lot too, but like sitting outside in the sun and listening to the senses, the more you can incorporate. Like, for me, like, I just sat and We had this miraculous like snow day today, which never happens in the South, so we're like crazy. But looking out the window and watching what's happening in your environment, like do that, whether it's a sunny day, rainy day, snowy day, it doesn't matter. But like there's something calming in just looking externally about what's going on around you and kind of feeling like you're in the matrix of like you're paused while the world is not. And then that can allow you to find the stillness too.
And it makes you feel small, I think. It makes you feel not necessarily insignificant, but kind of like, okay, what do I matter in this big cosmos where there's a storm happening or something? Well, Hillary, thank you so much for your time. It's been a true pleasure speaking with you, and I will link all your book, your social handles, your website, and everything in the show notes. If someone is in Texas, of course, they should be so lucky to go and go to your clinic and meet you in person. But truly, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much. It was wonderful.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Hillary. Thank you so much for tuning in. Go and give us both a follow on Instagram or YouTube. One more thing before you go, if you are looking for premium supplements, our partner Fat Muscle Project has got you covered. Head to their website for the best protein powders, creatine, vitamin D, and more, and feel free to use our code NCL at the checkout. Thank you for listening, and don't forget, life is too short to be in a body you don't feel good in.